Good morning, everyone. That's, I think, the best good morning response I've ever gotten. I should go away for a summer more often. That's great. It's really great to be back with you all this morning, to see so many faces, and I think some new faces, too. So it's just really, really lovely to look out and see each of you. And also, just to say that your care for your pastors and your care for me, you as individuals and you as a church body, made it possible for me to be away this summer and to have this extended Sabbath rest. And I come back to you full of gratitude for the rest that I was able to have, for the sleep that I was able to get. That was one of my very tangible goals. For the learning I was able to do, for the practices I was able to immerse in, for the time I was able to have with family and friends, and for the space to experience that renewal. Sabbaticals are important for pastors and for congregations, and as the MCUSA sabbatical recommendations say, Mennonites always have to make sure everybody stays humble, so... quote, congregations sometimes become bored or overfamiliar with one pastor's style, gifts, and perspectives. So a sabbatical away can be good for everyone. So perhaps this summer was a nice palate cleanser for you as well. Amanda and Melinda and Rod and Pam and Verna, I'm saying names and not finding faces at the same time, but... everyone on staff relations, all of you who preached and led worship and coordinated services and visited each other on behalf of the congregation and looked out for one another and just kept all the church, I guess you can say home fires burning, church fires burning doesn't sound quite right, but kept things going here. I know that there was a cost beyond just the budget for my sabbatical, and I know that many of you paid that in your time and your energy and your care. And saying thank you is inadequate, but also necessary. So thank you so much to all of you. And then tomorrow, most of you won't notice this until next Sunday as much, but tomorrow we get a new pastor here at CMCL. So Leslie Homer Cattell starts tomorrow. Bringing in a new era here at CMCL, and new leadership, new perspective, and a very welcome partner in ministry for Amanda, Melinda, and myself. So there's much to be grateful for as I return. So one of the things that I did in August of my sabbatical, I had a few retreats and workshops that were a week long spaced throughout the summer. And one of them was that I went up to Garrison, New York on the Hudson and did a week-long songwriting retreat with Dar Williams. I don't know if any of you are familiar with her. If you're not, her songs are just phenomenal. But the name of the retreat was called Writing a Song That Matters. And one of the really neat things about that week is it was not a week to learn how to write a hit. It was not a week to learn about how to get out there and, you know, promote yourself as a songwriter. It was literally a week to be in community with other people for whom song is one of the ways they express creativity and feel the voice of creativity coming through them, and to have this space where you share with one another. And it's about letting the authentic song come through, a song that matters. And one of the things that Dar said early on in the week as a writing prompt was that when she's writing, sometimes she looks at these questions for herself, so that when she comes back from the writing, she asks herself whether she can answer these questions. So in your writing, where did you go? What did you see? Did you really see? And then what did you bring back? And so I hope that I'll be bringing back a lot of things from my sabbatical here at CMCL. I will be telling some stories here this morning, but the idea of these sabbaticals is that they feed me and that they feed all of us for the time to come. And I look forward to seeing what comes of that as well. This morning's sermon is maybe a bit more of a reflection than a fully fleshed out exegetical sermonic work. I've only been in the office since Wednesday, and I'm used to kind of stewing and simmering over a text for much longer than 4 or 5 days. So this is a little bit more of sabbatical reflection than a traditional sermon, perhaps. So the theme for today is part of this arc of looking at creation. And the theme for today is humanity. I believe last week was Earth Sunday. And in some ways, actually, humanity was a big theme of my sabbatical, even though that's not a word that I used for it. On the very first day of my sabbatical, I jumped in the car and drove up to Connecticut to a Catholic retreat center on the Long Island Sound called Mercy by the Sea. I was at that particular place because it's halfway between here and Portland, Maine, and one of my very best friends and colleagues from seminary also had a sabbatical in ministry this summer, and we decided to meet each other halfway and sort of talk about what the last 16 years have been like for us and kind of be sounding boards for one another about where we're at in life and ministry. And we thought maybe we could be a good sounding board for the questions that each of us had and were coming up for us. And I thought, it'll be these great deep theological conversations like we had in seminary. And I do think we did help each other, but I think it was mostly in laughter and commiseration and in the questions that we each asked each other that neither of us would have thought to ask ourselves. But the biggest gift, I think, of those days with Cindy was that it gave me a reminder that I'm still that same person who went to seminary almost 20 years ago. Because the person that I was then came out to play with Cindy in June. And I realized that I still know her and I still am her. Me, that is, not Cindy. And the me that went to seminary at 23 and the me that started pastoring at 25 and the me that was just a young human following her heart and her curiosity and trying to figure out her calling in life. And it's one thing to know that intellectually, but it's another thing to see and feel that. I'm like, oh, there you are. Like, how long have I missed you? You've been in here all this time. Well, one of the unique beauties of that retreat center was a little beachfront that it has on the Sound, and there were many, many, many shells. And some were similar to shells that I've collected along the Atlantic coast, whelks, angel wings, conches, cockle shells. But curiously, there were actually only teeny, teeny, tiny versions of these. But on this beach, there was also a shell that I'd never seen before. And it looked like there was gold leaf scattered all along the beach, like a pirate's chest had been emptied there, but all the coins had been sort of worn down to just being leaf thin. Clearly, they were the inside of some kind of shell, where the outside had been worn down by water and sand, and there was only this iridescent yellow or gold or orange lining left. And I don't know if those shells are also on the beach where you're from in Long Island. It was new to me on that part of Connecticut. And so it wasn't until I was writing this sermon that I finally got on Google to try to figure out what these were. And I don't know what the scientific name is, but they're called jingle shells, which I thought was kind of odd. I guess because people make jewelry and lampshades out of them and they jingle or something like that. And actually, I'm going to pass some around now, or rather, Annalie and Aracel are. We'll start at the front and the back and pass around some of the gold jingle shells and some of the teeny, teeny, tiny whelks, so you can have a sense of the teeniness and also the beauty of the gold shells. But as I walked along the beach picking up these shells, I found myself moving almost immediately away from the sensory experience of these beautiful shells and right on to this, what could this mean? I'm sort of gathering gold on the first week of my sabbatical. Maybe this means like my inner treasure chest will be replenished. Maybe the tiny size of the shells mean I should pay attention to even the smallest things and that that's where the gifts of the sabbatical will be found. But I caught myself and I realized that I was not experiencing this beautiful place because I was already trying to hoard it away for some future sermon or some future tidbit of wisdom to pass on to somebody, or maybe a clever Facebook post, I don't know. But I realize that I do this so much, and I don't know if it's an occupational hazard, but I do it consciously or unconsciously. So I decided right there and then that one of my goals for the summer was to let the shells be shells and let me be me and not try to philosophize and put some deep meaning on everything I see. So as Mary Oliver says in her poem, Wild Geese, to let the soft animal of my body love what it loves, and to honor that the object of my love is its own subject, far beyond any object lesson I could hijack it for, and the pure joy of experiencing and beholding something that brings me delight and wonder, that is enough, even if it never fulfills the function of perhaps becoming the subject of a sermon or a song or a piece of art. I am allowed to experience just for the sake of experiencing. One of the things that sets humans apart from other animals is our capacity for just that kind of reflection and our inclination toward ruminating on things like this, I think. But this summer, it felt like the best way to honor my humanity was to try to cut back on that ruminating and to sink into my body and to just follow it and let it, and to be entirely in it as it walked around the world. In pastoring, as in many other related professions, in so many ways, the resource you bring to your work is just you and who you are. And so when you get tired and your heart and your mind get too full, it can feel like being a candle where the wick gets too long and it folds over on itself and suddenly the flame gets bigger and suddenly like the wax is burning down too fast and it's like dripping all over the place in a puddle. And I think it's often that our bodies are the ones that reveal the truth of our being and the truth of what's going on with us. Even though they can do amazing things in crises, our bodies, the truth of one's life is eventually borne out in the body. One of the books that I've been slowly reading through this summer is called The Wisdom of the Body, by Christine Walters Paintner. I'm holding it up because I recommend it. It's been a really wonderful book for me, A Contemplative Journey to Wholeness. In the introduction, she writes, Christ's incarnation points to embodiment as one of the most important spiritual journeys we make. If we believe God became flesh, how might we take the incarnation seriously by entering into intimacy with our own bodies? This is your body, your greatest gift, pregnant with wisdom you do not hear, grief you thought was forgotten, and joy you have never known. She invites readers to practice radical hospitality to ourselves in all forms, for in so doing we begin to draw together our broken pieces and return to wholeness. The handful of scriptures that were suggested for Humanity Sunday were reminders to me of how deeply entrenched we are, at least in Western, sort of European, Judeo-Christian culture, how entrenched we are in this notion of our set-apartness from creation, so unlike the call to worship that we read this morning. And this language of superiority to creation is all over the scriptures. In Genesis, we're declared to be made in the image of God and to be good, and right away, we're supposed to make sure there are lots of us out there and that we have dominion over all the creatures that we also get to give names to. In Psalm 8, we read that we are just lower than God and crowned with glory and honor, and that all creatures are under our feet. In Matthew and Philippians, the verses are about human squabbling between ourselves, about who is greatest, with the reminder that Christ, though equal with God, did not exploit that, but emptied himself and served. But there's a thread through all these passages that's actually unsurprising. It's just sort of a rearranging of the deck chairs on the ship of chosenness and superiority. But Well, we are the most powerful of all creatures, and our choice is just about making sure that we're properly benevolent about all of that superiority. But what good has this set-apartness done us or the world? The Akan people of Ghana record a lot of their traditional wisdom in a series of shorthand symbols called Adinkra symbols. You might be familiar with some of them. The Jinyame is very well known. The Sankofa, which is the bird looking back over its back, the idea of going back and getting what's in your history. But there's a less well-known one, at least here in the United States. And it's a symbol of, they're called Siamese crocodiles. And because it's sort of a geometric symbol, it's a four-pointed figure with a central circle, and there are two heads pointing out to the west and the north, and then two tails from the south and the east. And it's two crocodiles who share one belly or one stomach. And the idea to remember is that we are linked and our fates are tied to one another. And of course, this wisdom isn't just about crocodiles sharing stomachs with other crocodiles or humans sharing stomachs with other humans. But I think that we share a stomach with the crocodile. We share with the jingle shellfish, with the orcas of the Pacific, with the honeybees. The earth is screaming her confusion and fear and indignation, and we watch as if the body being burned was not our own. But this is what incarnation is about, God being with us. Christ came to share a stomach with us, to show us that there is no separate fate, that God is in it, that God even is all in. And I think there's tremendous significance to the fact that in the Christian story, God came to us in a body. Our capacity to reflect and ponder may be a human distinctive, but our physical characteristics are what mark us as Homo sapiens. We may have deeper sentience and souls, but we negotiate this life as physical bodies. The fodder for our thought and imagination is our lived, embodied experience in the world. So to follow Christ is to share bellies with the world. Sometimes I think, in reaction to the almost idolatrous emphasis in much of Christianity on the literality of Scripture, progressive Christians have lost the sense of the embodiedness of gospel. When we argue over a bodily resurrection, for example, we throw the body under the bus because we falsely equate physicality and literality too often. We lose sight of the significance of the fact that in the central story of our faith tradition, be it understood literally or mythologically, the incarnation was bodily. Jesus' healings were of bodies. The crucifixion was bodily. The resurrection was bodily. How can we love this world if we cannot love bodies? How can we love our world if we cannot love our bodies? How can we love our neighbors if we cannot love bodies? How can we be participants in the healing and care of the earth if we do not do so with our bodies? So much of the pain of the world comes from discrimination based on how people are embodied, or the judgments that others make based on how they observe another's embodiedness, how they look, how they act, how much space they take up, who they love, what piece of land their body happens to be on. Another book that I've been finally reading this summer is Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Probably most of you have seen this around. Again, it's phenomenal. I noticed, though, in reading that Coates almost never says the word me or myself or us, but rather he almost always says my body or our bodies or black bodies. And so I started underlining the places where he does this, and it's all over the book. Existence is not separate from embodiment. When the facts of your body put your body in danger, you don't easily forget that life is an embodied thing. You don't easily forget that you will be equated with your body, and your body will be respected or not based upon that. As women walking through the world, you don't forget your body without effort or intention. Creation, no matter how it happened, is idea or potential materialized. Word become flesh, and we encounter it with our senses. The hour is very, very late, and what we need, says mythologist Martin Shaw, is a great, powerful, tremulous falling back in love with our old, ancient, primordial beloved, which is the earth herself. So I invite you to come to me after the service if you would like. And if you would like to have a little golden jingle shell, I brought back many, some for all of you, I think, or a teeny tiny conch shell. This is full of those. And I welcome you to come see me after church if you would like one of those. And I want you to know that you do not have to attach any meaning to this shell. You don't have to say, oh, I'm going to try to remember what Susan's sermon was about. But just let the shell be a shell and a reminder to let you be you and to live into the beauty of who you are, and that we might love ourselves and the world all the better.